We're in for some more confusion today.
Just need one paper for her. The story of Jacob's sciatic nerve being kicked in.
I was just wondering, I'm sorry I had to miss last
week. Oh, it's okay, it's okay.
Do you have any extra copies?
Oh, yeah, I do. I think I've left them at home, actually.
Sorry, I've given them mine.
Oh, yeah, okay, I'll get one for you then, yeah. We were looking at...
Semiotics.
And that whispering of the angel. We looked at an Upanishadic text as well. It's a very strange text, whispering of the angel.
Did anybody listen this morning between 9 and 9:30? Humphreys, he was talking about an Islamic academic, Islamic theologian. Tariq Ramadan.
Oh yes, Tariq Ramadan.
He was very, very good. Far better explaining how to look at the Islamic text.
He gave a talk here about 3 days ago, 4 days ago. It's really very interesting.
Did the same person come?
Did you go to see it? Did you go to see it?
I missed it.
Oh yeah, he's really very good.
Yeah,
he spoke without...
This was a singularity. The person talked about singularity?
No. Oh no, not here. No, he spoke in Oriel College.
No.
But without a text, you know, just spoke off the top of his head, really lucidly.
Very good.
Got
a small suggestion for next term and the term onwards. I know you have lots of leaflets saying what like this or whatever. Would it be possible to make it into a calendar? Calendar program. Mm-hmm. Because, next time I'm not going to be here, but the following time, I'm an idiot, I miss the program.
Can we do send it out an email in calendar format?
No, it isn't a calendar format.
What do you mean by calendar format?
It's like, say, 29th of October. These are the lectures. 30th of October, this will be the lecture. That format is what I'm talking about. Rather than, yes, there are two formats. One is they're going to be 7 lectures by so-and-so on these days.
Oh, have you got one?
Yeah, I have.
Sorry. Yeah. So today we're going to look at Paul Ricoeur and his essay on the model of the text, meaningful action considered as a text. Now, you probably haven't had time to read it, and I haven't actually photocopied it, I'm afraid, but unless you had access to a copy yourself, you won't have read it. But I thought today we'd look at the argument of as I've sort of extracted it from the contents of the text itself, and then discuss it as we go along. So last week we looked at hermeneutics, and this week we'll look at the model of the text as a model, the text as a model for understanding social action. And that article by Ricoeur is particularly interesting, I think, because it raises questions about authorship, and he draws parallels between actions and authorial intention, as it were. So the author becomes like an actor, an agent. So I thought we'd just go through it. So I'll discuss it as we go through. So Ricoeur, then, he offers this hypothesis that the human sciences may be said to be hermeneutical insofar as their object, which is social action or society, displays some features constitutive of a text, and their method develops the same procedure as text interpretation. So that's his general claim. And this is my understanding of a summary of his argument. So first of all, what's hermeneutics? He says hermeneutics is a system in which a system of rules required for the interpretation of written documents. And that's an important thing that Ricoeur restricts the notion of text to a written document, which is interesting. So he excludes oral documents. So that will raise interesting questions or problems. And this is his thesis or his hypothesis. If there are problems which are raised by the interpretation of texts, because they are texts and not spoken language, then the human sciences may be said to be hermeneutical. One, inasmuch as their object displays some of the features constitutive of texts, and two, inasmuch as their methodology develops the same kind of procedures as those of text interpretation. So let's go over that again. It's quite not an easy hypothesis. So if there are problems which are raised by the interpretation of texts, which, and there are, because they are texts and not spoken language, then the human sciences may be said to be hermeneutical, inasmuch as their object displays some features which are similar to text. So the society or social action, he's claiming, is like a bit like a text. The object of if the top object of textual inquiry is a text, then social action, so the object of the social sciences, which is society or social action, is a bit like a text in some ways. That's what he's saying. That's his thesis.
Would it mean that, for example, if I do an interview with a patient, I'm talking to them, and I write it down, and then I have to analyze that?
Yeah.
As a psychologist, would that come under hermeneutics as well? If I say, you know, what I'm going to do is X, Y, Z, see whether these themes evolve, come out in my interview. Because in the hermeneutics, you say rules required for the interpretation of a written document.
Yeah.
So if I have a preset rules, and then I conduct an interview with a patient, for a psychology interview, then if I analyze it, would that be in a hermeneutic analysis?
Yeah,
even
it would
though
be.
It's a spoken language, but I've written it down, transcribed it, and I'm then analyzing it.
Yeah, I think that would be a, you'd be happy with that, don't you think? But there you've got the notion of a text, though, still. He's arguing that social action, say Brutus kills Caesar, we'll see in a minute, that's a social action.
Mm-hmm.
And that has analogues to text, to a text, he's arguing. So the object displays some features which he hasn't, this is the thesis, he hasn't argued it yet. And also their method of studying that object develops the same kind of procedures as those of text interpretation. So the method of the social sciences, sociology and so on, he's arguing is actually hermeneutical, like you just said.
He says that there are certain problems that are raised by interpretation of text because they are not spoken language. So is he saying that social action has more in common with texts than with social spoken language?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, he probably is. I never thought of it like that. Yeah, he could all be saying that spoken language... It's difficult, that, because spoken language is part of social action. So I think he wants to restrict the notion of text to a written document. And I guess spoken language, he would say, actually is part of the matrix of social interaction. So the object becomes not only a spoken language, but the context, the illocutionary, what you would call the illocutionary context of its occurrence kind of thing. So,
or maybe it's just that spoken language doesn't have parameters, whereas social action, if it's passed, then it's kind of bounded by that occurrence.
Because it's happened, hasn't it? Yeah,
right.
It's bounded by its occurrence, by time, yeah. But, yeah, that's right, spoken language has no boundaries, I guess, apart from grammar. You say what you like, can't you, within the limits of your imagination, or the social situation in which you are. I mean, that's his thesis anyway. It's an interesting thesis. It's not an obvious thesis, but it's interesting. Initially you think, social action isn't like text at all, but anyway, we'll see if we're convinced. So two questions here, two questions arise. A, to what extent is a text a good paradigm for the object of the social sciences? And B, to what extent may we use the method of the text interpretation as a paradigm for interpretation in general in the human sciences? So they're interesting questions, and he attempts to answer them. The next section, this is my dividing up of his text. He doesn't divide his own text up like this. This discourse is the first section, I think, in his text. And he first of all says discourse. What is discourse? Discourse refers to a world. The sentence, he says, designates its speaker in various ways. But what the text says now matters more than what the author meant to say. That's important. So the author, the text exceeds author's intention. So what the text means, for Ricoeur, what the text means now is more important than what the author intended to say. And in a sense, as he says it's in several places, all texts are equal to me. Whether it's a Vedā or whether it's a novel by James Joyce, they're all equal to me as the reader. No matter what the density of time, temporal density behind them is. You can pick off the Bhagavad Gita, or you can pick out, the Sun or something, and they're both texts available to me for a cur. You don't have to agree with them, but the point is that the texts exceed author's intention, and he's going to say that social action does too. So written discourse is distinct from spoken discourse in that it cannot be rescued by processes of intonation, gesture, etc. So you can clarify what you mean. I mean, what I've just said, I can go over it again and say, oh, I didn't mean that, I meant this, or I said that wrongly, or I can change my mind, or I didn't mean to say that at all. But a written discourse, he said, it's fixed. This taping me is actually fixing my discourse in objectionable ways. written discourse is distinct. So dialogue ultimately refers to a situation common to the interlocutors. So therefore, in the same way that the text frees its meaning from intention, so it frees its reference from the limits of ostensive reference. Ostensive means pointing. Only writing frees itself from its author and the narrowness of the dialogical situation. So the text is freed from intention, from the authorial intention. Text goes beyond it. You write something, write a poem, and it goes out into the world, and people read it in different ways, and you say, oh, I didn't... That's an interesting reading of the text. I didn't know you could read it like that. It never occurred to me. So the text exceeds authorial intention. And he's saying the same way that... social action, he will say, is goes beyond ostensive, what he calls ostensive reference. And only writing frees itself from its author and from the narrowness of the dialogical situation. So for Ricoeur, dialogical situation is limiting.
That's quite right, in a way. Because it's like the absolute example is the Bhagavad Gita. It was a dialogue between two people.
Yeah.
And what we read about into it today may be very different to what it was supposed to
yes.
be historically
yes.
to the two of them.
Yes. Yes.
So in a way,
this would be questioned, to what extent, how can we get back to original meanings of the text?
Mm.
And they're obviously written for different historical audiences, to us. So he moves on then. Discourse refers to a world and is characterized by sentences which designate their speakers by indicators of subjectivity such as personal pronouns, I, you. They call that deixis, or indexicality. In such cases, the intention of the speaker and the meaning of what is said coincide in contrast to the meaning of a written text which goes beyond the intention of the author. So when I say something, that verbal utterance corresponds to my intention, or your intention, or anyone's intention, but a written document, it doesn't. A written document goes beyond the intention of the author. A written discourse is distinct from the spoken discourse, for only with written discourse is interpretation the remedy for unclarity of meaning, or the weakness of discourse which the author can no longer save. That's phrase. In spoken discourse, this is not the case for misunderstanding. In spoken discourse, this is not the case, for misunderstanding can be remedied by clarification from the speaker. You can ask if there's time at the end of the lecture. Through intonation, through context of speech, and so on. Spoken discourse is therefore has an ostensive reference because it is only understood by speakers who are sharing a common situation, as opposed to written text. Written discourse, by contrast, is freed from ostensive reference and is open to a much wider audience. It is addressed not just to you, the second person, but to anyone who knows how to read. So for Ricoeur, writing is a revolutionary thing in human culture. Completely changes human culture for the better, for him. So only discourse and not language is addressed to someone and is the foundation of communication. But in text, the someone is anyone who knows how to read. So that's his understanding of the notion of discourse. having clarified that, that distinction between the written and the spoken, as it were, he then goes on to look at text and action. And his next question is then, moving on to sort of action itself, to what extent then can we say that the object of human sciences conforms to the paradigm of the text? If the object of the human sciences is meaningfully oriented behaviour, as Weber argued, to what extent can this be replaced by readability characters, what Ricoeur calls readability characters? How can you read social action like you can read a text? Are there characteristics of a text? Sorry, are there features of social action which are akin to the readability of a text? Are the features of a text, like it's a... I guess one readability feature is that it's written in a text, but there are other kind of indicators as well. So he then goes on to argue, okay, A, action is meaningful because the actual action as meaningful may become an object of science. Okay, it's fair enough. But an action may also have an illocutionary force. What's an illocutionary force? Do you know what illocutionary? It means there was a philosopher called Austin and also another one called Searle who wrote about language and speech act theory. And there's a distinction between locutionary statements, which are ordinary statements of fact or something like the table is yellow. It's a locutionary statement. And there's illocutionary statements, which are statements which perform actions. So I name this ship as the Queen bashes the champagne against the side of the ship is an illocutionary speech act. And there's a third category, perlocutionary acts, which are expressive of an inner state. It's like a state of pain. Oh, I have a toothache. The perlocutionary speech act. All this lecture's giving me a headache.
Was that a Freudian speech?
So Searle is mainly concerned with illocutionary acts, and there's a big debate about what are the limits of illocutionary speech acts. Indeed, whether all language has illocutionary force in some sense. So what's particularly interesting about illocutionary acts is something called deixis, or indexicals. I think this is a really important big area of research, really just being... or indexicality. And that's all referring to... the idea that language, the meanings of language, are particularly revealed through indicators such as I, you, here, there, this, now, those kinds of words, which are called indexicality, which can only be understood in the context. You can only understand here, or now, or then, there, you, I, because of the situation, the speech situation in which they occur. So you get the whole something called discourse analysis developing, which looks at indexicals. There's a guy called Genet, who wrote a book about two years ago, another, he was a very famous French linguist, called Metalepsis. I don't know, I haven't looked up the etymology of that, but that's... another word for deixis or indexicality is metalepsis. I don't know why they have such a proliferation of terms. I don't know what meta means. Lepsis. What's lepsis? Do you know what lepsis means? I don't know. No. Anyway, but it's that's his book. It's called Metalepsis, but it's all about indexicality. Yeah, and you can look at text. You can read text in terms of indexicality. It's very interesting how texts... indexicals function in texts, and you get something called anaphora, which is Claire said, "I'm going to the river," the I in that sentence, I'm going to the river, is said to be anaphoric, because anaphora refers to the person previously named in the discourse. So often takes of third person discourses. So Claire said, I'm going to the river, is a third person discourse within which you've got a first person discourse operating. But you can only understand the I, the indexical I, with reference to the person named previously, Claire. So that's anaphora. But this can get quite a sophisticated kind of analysis of this. So poetry, I wandered lonely as a cloud, is Wordsworth's poem, I wandered lonely as a cloud. The I is dequoted, the quotation marks are taken away from it, and it's not that Claire said I wandered lonely as a cloud, it's I wandered lonely as a cloud. So that dequoted, the dequotation of the I allows for the identification of the indexical I of the reader with the I of the text, with the internal I of the text. And so plays would be another example of that. So you get a whole spectrum, if you like, of discourse from a third person discourse through to a first person discourse, and you get, so anaphora, third person discourse would be like a report or something like that. Then you get anaphoric texts. Claire said, I'm going to the cinema. And then you get plays in which the I, for example, the I of the reader the character takes over the I of the actor. So a horse, my kingdom for a horse, that's the actor's eye is subsumed within the eye of the character. And then further down that line you get something like possession, where the eye becomes completely subsumed by the other eye who takes you over in religious, some kind of religious ecstasy or something. So the Teum dancers of Kerala, you get the dancer's eye, the indexical eye, becomes subsumed beneath the eye of discourse, the eye of the text. So in that, those Teum possession rites, he says, he speaks in a third person discourse. She is a marvellous, wonderful goddess, all powerful. And then in a second person, you are a marvellous, wonderful goddess. And then in the first person, as she looks into a mirror, I am a wonderful, marvellous. So that the eye of the actor becomes subsumed by the eye of the goddess. I don't. That's nothing to do. Well, it's vaguely to do with this, but sorry.
It's interesting.
Yes, yeah, it's quite interesting. That. So anyway, action then, illocutionary force, I name the ship. An illocutionary act is one performed by a speaker by uttering words such as promising or threatening, right there, essay, which can have perlocutionary consequences, a headache through writing the essay or something. That is, the effect of the illocutionary speech act, such as making someone hopeful or frightening them. Action has a structure of action has a structure of a locutionary act. Locutionary act is just a statement, a proposition. It has propositional content. So, e.g., Brutus killed Caesar. I think I've spelled Caesar wrong. Can be understood whether or not Brutus killed Caesar. Doesn't matter whether Brutus killed Caesar. We can understand the statement, the sentence. And Ricoeur calls this a noematic structure of action. They become an object to interpret. Noematic from phenomenology, if you remember, noema is the object of inquiry, of phenomenological inquiry, and noesis is the process or the means or the method for understanding the noema, the object of inquiry, the intentional object. So the noematic structure of action, by that he means the intentional structure of action, really, the action which is intended by actors or a group of actors, becomes an object open for interpretation. An action then may be identified not only by its propositional content, Brutus killed Caesar, but by its illocutionary force. So So action, he says, is like a speech act, like I name this ship. So action is like that. What is fixed by writing is the noema of the speaking. This is his language. And what is done, fixed by doing, is inscribed. So in some sense, you've got the a text a text is the product of authorial intention and is therefore a noematic object, an intentional object. So social action is an object or a noematic object of actors' intention. So I go and get a cup of coffee in Borders or something. That's an intentional action, and it's a noematic. It has a noematic structure in that it has an object of intention which is then performed. And Recurse says that action is a bit like a text.
I'm a bit confused by how an action is both locutionary and illocutionary.
In language, I mean, it's clear that Brutus killed Caesar is locutionary.
Right. But as an action.
As an action.
It's illocutionary.
That's a bit strange in that particular example, because illocutionary speech acts are things like, I name this ship, I promise to pay the bearer on demand or something, or I do in a marriage ceremony or something. They're all illocutionary acts. But there's locutionary statements are just statements like the table is yellow. Action. There's some actions which are like propositions for recur, this is very interesting. But other actions which have illocutionary effects. So I'm trying to think, actually, surely for recur, all actions must be illocutionary.
I'm not sure. I feel like he's talking about two different distinctions between locutionary and illocutionary.
Yeah.
One is locutionary, it doesn't change anything about the world, whereas illocutionary does change something. It has prolocutionary effects.
Yeah.
But the other distinction he might be making is that locutionary statements can be understood, have force outside of their context, whereas illocutionary statements have no force except within a certain context.
Ah, so brilliant.
And that might be what he's referring to as an action has locutionary content in that it's understood outside its context.
Yeah.
But he seems to be going back and forth.
Yeah, he does a bit. That's a good, excellent point. I hadn't seen that. Did you ever get that? What?
No. Please, sorry.
I mean, there are two distinctions between... You can say that there are two distinctions between locutionary and illocutionary statements.
Yeah.
One is that a locutionary statement, saying the table is red, it doesn't change anything. It's just a statement of fact. The table is red. You're not making the table red. However, an illocutionary statement, I dub thee Sir Lancelot, that's changing something. The statement is an action. The statement...
Yeah.
Causes a change in the world. It's what he calls has prolocutionary force. It, will make a person feel a certain way, for example. So that's one distinction. The other distinction is that locutionary statements are meaningful outside of their immediate context. So, for example, if I say the table is red, if you say the table is red, if someone says the table is red, it has meaning, independent of whether the table is really hear or who's speaking. Whereas I dub thee Sir Robin, it only has meaning if there's, if Robin or Lancelot is there and the king is there and the king is speaking to Robin. So once you take that statement outside its context, it loses its illocutionary force.
Yeah.
It's no longer an active statement.
He oscillates between those two, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can say Brutus killed Caesar, as a statement, it's locutionary in that it can be understood outside its context.
Yeah.
But the action, Brutus killed Caesar, is illocutionary because it changes something about the world.
Changes history or something. That's right. Yeah. So yeah, he goes on to clarify some of that a bit. So a text is detached from its author. So an action is detached, as a text is detached from its author, so an action is detached from its agent and develops consequences of its own, like Brutus and Caesar. Actions have effects unintended by agents. The doer is present to his doing in the same way that the speaker is present to his speech. In simple actions, the meaning, which is the noema, and the intention, or the noesis, coincide in simple actions. But with complex actions, some segments are so remote from the initial segments which express the intention of the doer that the ascription of these actions constitutes a problem parallel to that of authorship. So, I want a cup of tea, I make a cup of tea, that's the meaning and intention coincide. But with complex actions, so I can't think of, like opening the Houses of Parliament or something, some segments are so remote from initial segments which express the intention of the doer. I can't think of an example. Well, Brutus killed Caesar would be an example. That the ascription of these actions constitutes a problem parallel to that of authorship. So Brutus killed Caesar. Brutus is partly the author of that action. Brutus kills Caesar, but the implications of that action far exceed Brutus's killing of Caesar, but Brutus can have no control or no cannot foresee the consequences of those actions. It kind of ripples out. So Brutus kills Caesar is a complex action, which has consequences far removed from the intention of the doer. So he goes on, as a locutionary act is said, and perhaps written in a text, so action can be done, and in one sense inscribed or written on history. He's got this interesting idea of history as this sort of thing which is received, which is inscribed or written on. In the same way that a text is detached from its author and exceeds authorial intention, so an action, by virtue of being done, exceeds its agent and develops consequences of its own, which were perhaps unintended. But we all know this from our just being alive, really. You do things that have unintended consequences. Completed actions go beyond the immediate environment of their occurrence, while actions may correspond to agent's intention, their interpretation, and indeed their consequences exceed that intention. History, writes Ricoeur, is this quasi-thing on which human action leaves a trace, puts its mark. An action can exceed ostensive reference, go beyond the social conditions of its immediate production, as we were saying earlier, and, like a text, addresses an indefinite number of possible readers. As long as it's recorded or remembered, of course. Is that a baby?
Yeah.
It's got a horse. It's got a, yes. An irate parent, too. Action as an object is made possible by inner traits of action which are similar to the structure of the speech act and which make doing a kind of utterance. So he's saying there are inner traits of action which are like texts. So the basic point is the meaning of an action can be detached from the event of the action. That's a fundamental point. So you can have an action, Brutus kills Caesar, but the meaning of that event exceeds the event. The meaning of the action exceeds the event of the action. So this event distinction, a bit like authorial intention and interpretation, I suppose. So history, then, is a record of human action, this quasi-thing on which human actions leave a trace. Archives are intentionally written down, and there's a process of recording action. Human actions, over time, lose connections with intentions of actors. Why did you get married? Oh, I can't remember now. Something like, or whatever it is. your human actions lose connections with the intentions. Your original intentions. Why did you start learning Sanskrit and you just can't remember? So the human actions lose their connection with the intentions. Meaning resides in the work itself, in the action itself. And the object of the social sciences is rule, govern behaviour. I thought, as Peter Winch talks about this a lot in his book, Philosophy of the Social Sciences, about 40 years ago now, but an important book in which he made the same observation. Meaning resides in the work itself. So meaning doesn't reside in the authorial intention of the actors, but in the actions itself. So, but I didn't mean that. I didn't mean my actions to have those consequences. Is a bit pathetic in a sense, because the actions, somebody's actions exceed their intentions. I didn't mean to kill him. I think even this is even encoded in law, isn't it? I don't know. The actions. I don't know.
Isn't there where the law comes up? Did you actually intend to kill him, so there was a motivation, or whether I didn't mean to kill him? But my action caused that. So
yes, manslaughter.
You end up with, this is where the distinction of manslaughter and
murder
comes
indeed.
In criminal, they do that.
Yeah, they do that. They do allow that distinction, don't they?
They have that in the Talmud, Jewish law. There are like five levels. Like if you kill someone, like there are five levels of how intentional it was.
Oh, I see. So that does take, that is important then, the intentions. Yeah.
And the same thing, I suppose, in the Hindu Dharma that you can talk about. Kamya karma, what was the intention behind the action?
So the intention does matter, doesn't it?
The intention is the most important part in Hindu Dharma.
Yeah. But meaning resides in the action itself, says Ricoeur, not in the intention behind it. The meaning of an action is in itself, not in the intention behind it. So the meaning of the murder is the murder. Not the intention, whether you intended to kill them or not, is. Or for Ricoeur, he says it's not as important as the meaning of the action itself.
And isn't that actually looking at only part of the picture?
Yeah, it is. I agree. Yeah, the intention is important. So I guess Brutus kills Caesar, whether Brutus intended to. It's inconsequential to the effect of the action on history, for example. That would be something like that.
And this is where I find that the same thing, like saying the table is red, is a fact, not fiction. But if I say the table is red because Gavin painted it red.
Yeah.
Now, if I add another sentence to it, then it completely changes. According to this person, it becomes a locutation or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is that if you look at part of the picture, you get one. But when you start looking at the whole picture, the whole thing changes.
Yeah, it's more complex.
It becomes more complex. So when you're doing a discourse, say, analysis, so if you see the beginning, the middle, and the end, then the picture changes completely. Rather, you can get these just very factual statements if you only look at bits.
Right. Yeah. I think Ricoeur would agree with that actually, as you build up a complex picture, and that's what history is really, building up of a complex picture through time, you get more perspective on things the further on you go through history. But his point is, I guess, which is, a meaningful action is an action, the importance of which goes beyond its relevance to the initial situation. An action exceeds its initial situation. I guess he means the effects of the action exceed the initial situation. And he says this parallels the way in which texts breaks ties of discourse to all ostensive reference. So as a text is freed from ostensive reference, so an action is freed from ostensive reference in the immediate situation. That's what he says. Freed from the situational context, discourse can develop non-ostensive reference. Freed from the situational context, discourse can develop non-ostensive reference, which you call a world. and the creation of a world corresponds in the field of action to the non-extensive non-ostensive reference to a text.
Right, what exactly is
ostensive? Ostensive means pointing to something. Right. Yeah. So it's like a bit like locutionary in a way. So, mm-hmm. So it's indexicality again. I, you, here is pointing to a situation. So, texts, this is easy. And texts are freed from ostensive reference because they have a meaning outside of author and intention, outside of the here and now of discourse. So they're freed from ostensive reference, but and he says, well, actions are like that too. Well, some actions, not all. I mean, I scratch my head. That has no non-ostensive reference at all. But actions like Brutus kills Caesar do. They have effects beyond when Napoleon marched into Jena. Has much more. Effects. One of the, Napoleon marches into Jena. Hegel is watching from his window when he's writing the Phenomenology of the Spirit. So you could say that the actions, Hegel's preface to the Phenomenology of the Spirit, was influenced by was a consequence, unintended consequence of Napoleon marching into Jena.
But what makes something a meaningful action? You know, he's distinguishing between just an action and meaningful action. It seems like it's just arbitrary. A meaningful action is an action which has consequences that go beyond the intention. But that can be any action. It's just which whatever happens to have that happen.
That's right. It's very good. So, I mean, this is a meaningless action, me scratching my head. But, in chaos theory or something, you might have consequences way beyond that, you know.
Right. I mean, someone might think that means that you're really bored or something.
Yeah.
What happens if I recorded your scratching of your head, and 10 days down the line, I look at it, and I suddenly feel there is a meaning to that.
Yeah.
The reason is because I've seen what time that you do scratch your head. Maybe the beginning of the lecture or the end of the lecture.
That's right.
If it's the beginning of the lecture, he says, why the heck am I doing the lecture?
Yeah.
Or at the end of the lecture, when is this ever going to finish?
Yes, why do you think that?
Yeah.
If the lecturer thinks that, the students are going to be very bored.
Sorry.
That's right, yeah. That's a good point. I mean, what's a meaningful action? What isn't a meaningful action?
I mean, it's just tautological.
Yeah. Is a meaningful action only determined by others? Is it determined by the intention of the actor? Is the meaning? It might not be. I mean,
it's determined by the action.
But also possibly by the consequences or the interpretation. Mm-hmm. So, you remember the Life of Brian? Do you ever see that?
Yes.
His shoe falls off, doesn't he? And he picks up his shoe, and everyone's saying, "Oh, it's the shoe sign or something." So a meaningless action has meaningful consequences for the, or whatever. I don't know. Let's whiz through this argument quickly in the next 5 minutes. This approach of action as text offers a new interpretation of the relation between understanding and explanation. Another big thing about recurring. Picks up on this Diltai's distinction between understanding, which is hermeneutics, and explanation, which is arguably, Diltai doesn't say this, but what is an explanation? Arguably an explanation is the location of a cause. You could say that an explanation is the location of a cause, whereas an understanding is a more sort of holistic penetration of the meaning of something. So recursive, the paradigm of reading then provides a solution to the methodological paradox of the human sciences. That is, if there's a gap between explanation and understanding, how can human sciences be scientific at all? So the tradition was that science explains and the human sciences interpret or understand. So you read the Gita or the Torah and you understand it, and you don't, explanation is something different. So
when they say social sciences, what are, I mean, are they referring to like sociology and psychology?
Yeah.
Aren't those looking for explanation?
He's drawing on the Geisteswissenschaft and the Naturwissenschaft. So he calls it human sciences.
Mm-hmm.
He means social science. He also means English literature.
Okay.
And Indology probably. But by he means the natural sciences versus everything else.
Okay.
So that, I mean, in the English speaking world, you've got natural sciences, human sciences like humanities, and social science.
Mm-hmm.
So he's eroding the distinction between social science and humanities.
And he thinks that social science is looking for understanding and not explanation.
Yeah, he's more inclined towards that. More inclined towards that, as Diltang is. Yeah.
Okay.
But he problematizes it. If there's a gap between explanation and understanding, how can the human sciences be scientific? If science is characterized by explanation, which is the location of a cause, how can the human sciences be scientific? You could say, well, no, they're not. Gadamer might come along and say, well, they're not scientific. Four traits constitute the objectivity of a text, he says. First of all, fixation of meaning. Could argue that it's not fixed at all. Two, dissociation from mental intention of the author. Okay. Display of non-ostensive reference. Because it's freed from its location. And a universal range of addresses, or address, could be addressees, I mean, there. Addressees. Addresses. And then he concludes his article with the importance of the art of guessing, and guesses can be validated, guessing with regard to the text. And there's a dialectic, he says, from explanation to comprehension or understanding, and vice versa. And he says, it's also not true that all interpretations are equal, as the text is a limited field of possible construction. So he goes against some postmodern ideas that a text, that all interpretations of a text are valid. There are restrictions on interpretation for him, which I think is a reasonable position, really. So the constraints on interpretation are formed through philology and these other kinds of sciences that occur. He also said that explanation requires understanding, so he wants to place primacy on understanding of human actions and text as well. And there are two different stages. The structure, where he says, the structural analysis, where he's writing in the 70s, structural analysis is a stage between naive interpretation and depth interpretation. Then explanation and understanding are two different stages of this, what he calls the hermeneutical arc. And this structural model may be extended beyond the text to all social phenomena, as indeed structuralism did do with Levi-Strauss and people like that. So that's his argument in that article. So we've highlighted a number of problems with it. One is, when is action meaningful? What is a meaningful action? That is a problem. And is the meaning of the action, you could say the meaning of the action is determined by the actor, by the author, the agent. Ricoeur says actually the meaning of the action exceeds the agent. And what do you do with actions which are perhaps meaningless? Stahl argues that ritual is meaningless action, but nevertheless has perlocutionary force, you could argue. Meaningless actions do have perlocutionary force in the actors. Actually, can you have a mean? Isn't action by definition meaningful? I'm wondering, can you have meaningless action?
And the only action I can think has got no meaning is when a doctor taps on your knee and you reflexly kick him.
That's a reflex, isn't it?
That's a reflex. It's an action.
Yeah.
But a reflex action has got no meaning.
Mm.
Well, you have an explanation,
but
no meaning.
But it might have unintentional consequences. I mean, you could argue that the intention is the intention of the doctor rather than of you, but the action itself. I mean, what if you kick something, that hit something, and like sort of bucket falls on someone's head.
That's right. Kick the cat, and the cat jumps and scratches someone. Yeah, that's right. So that's what would that be then? That would be an unintentional action.
The doctor's action was meaningful.
Yeah.
But the patient's reaction.
Yeah.
Now is that meaningful, or does the whole thing come under one envelope?
Yeah.
I don't know. And the other point that I have got a problem with, he says, is how do you explain explanation and understanding? 2 + 2, you can't explain it as cause and effect as being 4. 4 is not caused by 2 + 2.
No.
So that's a science, still.
Is mathematics a science? I guess so.
Well, I think mathematics is used by science.
It's used by science, yeah.
I mean, like, 2 + 2 + 4, I mean, that's just a given.
Yeah.
But you use the a priori truths to prove and explain other things like calculus, for example. I mean, geometric proofs.
Yeah. Yeah. So explanation and interpretation. I don't know. Well, we can understand 2 + 2 = 4. There's understanding there, but I don't know what the explanation of it would be. You could have a logical proof. I suppose actually the 2 + 2, we understand that, and the explanation is that, isn't it?
Right.
That's the explanation from 2 + 2 = 4. We understand it, but the explanation is that. It's a rule. Mathematical rule. I don't know, I'm not very good at maths. But there's a bigger question here that I'd like you to sort of consider. It's quite an interesting argument, but is it credible? Is social action like a text? Is that really the case? When you read a text, read a novel, read Mahabharata, read the story of Nala, is social action like that at all? I think in some ways it is, but in other ways I think it's far from the mark, really. Because you spent too much time in Paris. What do you think?
I mean, one of his major claims is that social action is like a text, and that, you have the actor, and the actor has an intention, and that intention produces the act.
Mm.
But the act has consequences and meanings that extend beyond what the intention of the actor.
Sure.
And for a text, it's similar. And the author has an intention, produces a text, but the text has meaning that exceeds it. But I think the difference is how they're bounded by time.
Yeah.
In action, it's over once the actor has completed it.
Mm.
And so while, and its consequences might be dependent on the time that the action takes place, or they might be dependent on times that come afterwards. Whereas the text, it maintains its integrity throughout time.
Yeah.
Whereas the integrity of the act changes throughout time.
Yeah, the integrity of the act changes throughout time, So the action, once the authors have finished or died or whatever, it's finished, or the historical situation, there's a beginning and an end, and not precise, but...
You could argue that the consequences of the action mean that the action is continuing.
Yeah.
But the nature of the action is changing over time.
Yeah.
And in that case, you could say that a text is bound and an action is not.
Yeah. Action. Yeah. So the French Revolution would be an example. The French Revolution, certain boundedness, but far exceeds the action itself. And much greater consequences, one would have thought, but social action has greater consequences than text.
And in that way, the consequences of the social action, the interpretations of the social action, become part of the action.
Yeah.
Whereas for a text, the interpretations, are they part of the text or are they not part of the text?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, well, maybe Strauss would say, the interpretations are part of the text.
Mm-hmm.
But others who want to maintain that, what's the name we looked at last week, 2 weeks ago, Hirsch, would want to maintain a strict separation between the text and its interpretations. Yeah.
I had one author make this statement that said, I've written in this book what I wanted to write.
Yeah.
But what you make of it is entirely up to you and how you understand it.
Yeah.
I have no control over it.
Yeah.
So in that way, text actually can keep having the effect of that text. As long as the text exists,
yeah,
the effect will exist.
Right. Yeah.
So in a way, it's time is dependent upon how many people actually have continued to read that text.
Yeah. Yeah.
While a human action, because it has got lots of other ripple effects and keeps continuing, the original action does not.
So I think that this is, I think we have to go out. It's not a test thing. It's
a
real one.
Well, I think we'll finish then. And next week we're looking at a theories of reception and Stanley Fish's wonderful article, Is There a Text in This Class? Which is great fun.
In the middle of the school, is there a text?
Is there a text in this class?
My supervisor just mentioned that article yesterday.
I'll take my coat.
I'm sorry.
Don't have me up to me.
Which one of you is smoking?
I think it's down something to the kitchen or downstairs.
Do have a read of Paul Ricoeur's article if you get a chance. I can say what's it for you if you like.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.
I'm sure this isn't real.
for the thingy.